The European Union has not treated us well.
Stupid European elites jumping off the cliffs once again.
Yes, you are the guilty people, and you refuse to accept it.
This is EU Scream, the progressive politics podcast from Brussels. I'm James, a journalist who's crisscrossed Europe for 15 years now, covering politics and the economy.
I'm Tom. I've been a lobbyist and spin doctor in Brussels for many years, and I've spent the last decade fighting climate change.
In this episode, how the European far right uses and abuses climate change. Britain's UKIP has a long history of denial, while France's Marine Le Pen uses global warming to whip up fears about the mass arrivals of refugees. We also listen again to our interview with Bas Eickhout, the Dutch Green vying for a top job in Brussels. Eickhout shares his thoughts on the far right's climate record, and he talks about the bungled tax on diesel fuel in France that helped spark the huge Yellow Vests protests. Hey, Tom.
Hey, James. How are you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good, good, good. So we've got the school strikes for the climate that are going on right now on our minds.
As we sit here and talk, hundreds of thousands, if not indeed millions, of school children are preparing to walk out of their schools in order to protest the fact that there is not enough climate action going on. This is brilliant. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, hats off to Greta Thunberg and the other leaders of the climate school strikes. It's just a brilliant, brilliant thing that they're doing.
Yeah, one of the political forces that, generally speaking, doesn't approve of what the kids are advocating for is the European far right. Far right populists are often opposed to climate measures and to making the energy transition.
They are, yeah. And you've got an interesting overlap between a lot of right-wing populism and climate denial.
Yeah, and we're probably going to see a lot more harm to climate policy as they gain power in the next European Parliament after the May elections. That said, there are very significant and hugely surprising variations among these parties. Climate policies are really your area of expertise, and plus, there's actually a really meaty report about this that was released late last month.
It was indeed.
And we skipped it at the time, but we're making up for it now, and it's from a research organization called Adelphi out of Berlin.
Based out of Berlin, yeah.
Okay. I looked over this report. I thought it was actually really great. It's a good read. I figure the interesting way to kind of leap into it is to go into the three things that surprised me the most. Are you good with that?
Yeah, yeah. No, go for it, man.
Number one. UKIP is an outright climate denial party.
Oh, yes. Ooh, yes. Actually, kind of in the tradition of almost kind of the American alt-right. I mean, great example is the MEP Roger Helmer. There's a very significant moment in the campaign to establish climate denial as a political position. One of the key things that happened is in 2009, a bunch of emails got hacked from a climate research unit at the University of East Anglia. In the UK. A big pile of those emails were later released, and a huge amount of propaganda was spread about them in order to try and undermine the scientists who built the very important climate model.
That was a really big scandal at the time.
It's massive. It's become known as ClimateGate. So the hack happens at some point late summer, early autumn, 2009. And obviously at the end of that year is the Copenhagen Climate Summit. And indeed, I remember being in Copenhagen and those stories starting to break.
You remember being in Copenhagen with me.
Yeah, indeed. You were there, right?
Yeah. And chasing Barack Obama around the building.
Indeed.
Who, in turn, was trying to find the other leaders from the developing countries who were all meeting separately in the room without him.
Exactly. And Hillary Clinton was running around. I mean, the whole thing kind of collapsed. But just before the summit started, Roger Helmer, MEP, UKIP MEP, hosted a meeting of US climate deniers. They were brought together in Brussels exactly at the moment when the hack was released, when the propaganda war started, and just before the Copenhagen conference. Coincidence? Maybe.
And so they took that opportunity to whip it up.
Yeah, of course, of course. Right. And they were appearing on TV shows and they were appearing on radio and they were trying to say, look, 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 these scientists have been making up the science, which of course they absolutely had not.
This is the party of Brexit, the party that forced ex-UK Prime Minister Cameron to hold the UK referendum. And they are off the reservation. This is crazy, stuffed in crazy, wrapped in more crazy.
I mean, they literally, like, Newton's first law of physics doesn't exist stuff. I mean, they're, like, proper mad.
And Adelphi finds that of around the 25 most important climate proposals that went through the European legislative process from 2009 to 2018, UKIP, while it was mostly led by Nigel Farage, or at least fronted by him, voted against all of them.
Every single one.
Every single one.
UKIP is the hardcore of populist right-wing climate denial in Europe.
Number two, Hungary's Fidesz ain't so bad after all.
Okay, go.
Okay, so obviously Hungarian democracy is being dismantled by Viktor Orban. He's the leader of Fidesz and the prime minister of Hungary. He's doing a great job of demonizing Muslims, generally making Christian democracy neither Christian nor democratic.
Indeed. You've got to give him some credit.
So we covered this in our last two shows, the situation in Hungary, some of the people that Orban is attacking. But here's something I did not expect at all. Orban's Fidesz party is campaigning for international greenhouse gas emissions reductions to mitigate climate change and fully supporting the Paris Agreement. Adelphi makes a really topical point here amid all the clamor to boot Orban out of the European center-right political grouping, the European People's Party, by saying that center-right coalitions with Fidesz could be important for advancing climate and energy policy at the European level in the years to come. That said, Adelphi does ding Hungary for being weak on domestic climate action, partly using these appeals to global action as a reason to be less ambitious at home.
Right.
I mean, I guess the journalist in me really likes these sort of contradictory stories.
It points to a couple of things. Orban's been very, very keen to establish himself as a global leader. And indeed, as they point out, Hungary's done almost nothing at home. I mean, their domestic climate action is almost zero. So this is costing him nothing, right? So turning up on the world stage and saying, oh, yes, I support the Paris Agreement and I'm, you know, I'm a significant and kind of thoughtful global leader and I can be part of international processes and all of that is costing him nothing. I mean, he's not actually doing anything about it. He's talking some warm words. Okay, I guess it's better than outright climate denial on some scale. But I think to suggest that Fidesz is a kind of pro-green, pro-climate action party is probably somewhat overdoing it. That does actually point to something of a weakness in the methodology of this report, possibly, because they also point to Fidesz having been relatively, if you look across these 28 votes that they analysed, being relatively supportive of climate law. Now, of course, the hard yards in the European Parliament are not done in plenary. They're done in committee. And that's where pieces of legislation get watered down, where goals are reduced, where compromises get made. All of that stuff happens in committee. By the time it gets to plenary, there are very few things that are contentious. So it's not hard to be supportive of most of that legislation.
That sort of granular look at the committee work and how things get watered down. Yeah, it would be fantastic to see maybe another chapter in that report that deals with that dimension.
Right, and it's hard, right? I mean, yeah. This would not be an easy piece of work to do. But, you know, a bunch of academics and think tankers like Adelphi might actually have some fun with that. If you could actually go back and kind of dig into every committee process. But basically, to do that, you've got to go and interview people who were there. And it would take a while.
Okay, number three. Marine Le Pen uses the climate to stoke fears about migration. References to the extreme weather events that are affecting Europe are just not really part of Marine Le Pen's programs and statements. And that's negligent. There are droughts across Europe affecting farming, affecting industry. It's going to get worse. She also calls the UN climate body, I can never remember its name, even though I used to cover it as
the UNFCCC, so the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Very good, thanks. Calls that a communist project. However, she does see one threat from climate change, climate refugees, whereby millions could claim, in her vision, asylum in France. So basically the main climate issue for her party, which is the second most important political party in France, is to concoct a narrative about how climate policy and the climate elite is giving climate migrants, I guess those who are fleeing from affected parts of the world, a legal title for asylum in Europe.
Yeah, when the whole furore kicked off around the UN Migration Pact, which obviously became a rallying point for the far right in Europe, all of a sudden it was notable how many on the far right very briefly started to believe in climate change as one of the potential drivers of migration. Now, it is without doubt the case that the impacts of climate change are going to move vast numbers of people. And indeed, societally, how we respond to that is going to be really, really key to what plays out. And we're talking really realistically over the next 10 to 20 years. Now, we need to have a serious conversation, for sure. And what Marine Le Pen is obviously doing is trying to set up the guns and fences. But the problem with the guns and fences route that a lot of these people are talking about, it doesn't involve climate mitigation. So what it involves is getting the guns and fences running, but the problem just escalating and getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And where does that end? Well, it doesn't take a genius to paint that picture.
Progressives really need to get on top of that narrative. You can see how that far-right narrative is a narrative with legs unless there is a countervailing narrative that says we can have progressive policies that deal with this in a humane way without amplifying the feelings that some people in society have about being overwhelmed by migration.
So these politics are changing. A large group of conservative ministers have come out with a statement supporting the climate strikes, whereas these kids have been criticised heavily by a lot of right-wing politicians, actually, in the UK and many other places. A lot of them have said, oh, you know, they should be back in school. What are these children doing? So these politics are changing. And that runs very, very hard up against the narratives that the far right have been creating on this, because these kids are saying inclusion. They're saying, we don't want a world in which people suffer horribly, right? We don't want the guns and fences outlook here. That's not the world that we want. We want an open world. We want a world where we all support each other through this horrible and horrendous crisis we're about to experience. And we are about to experience it. So divided communities go the guns and fences route. Cohesive communities could potentially actually manage this pretty effectively.
Bas Eickhout is a member of the Dutch Green Left, and he's all about protecting the climate without penalizing ordinary working people. He's also been a prominent member of the European Parliament since 2009, and now he's a candidate for the European Greens to succeed Jean-Claude Juncker as president of the European Commission. That's a long shot. The job usually goes to a conservative, liberal, or a socialist. But Europe's political landscape is fragmenting. If the Greens, who currently hold around 7% of the seats in the European Parliament, end up with closer to 10%, they could play a significant role in deciding who runs Europe and how it's run through the middle of the next decade. Eickhout and I talked in December about how to fight global warming while avoiding the violent backlash against green policies that helped spark the giant Yellow Vests protests in France. I first asked him why training as a chemist was such good preparation for becoming a European lawmaker.
It can be helpful in the negotiations. Then you feel that people know, okay, we don't agree with him, but at least we need to do our homework when we talk to him. And that's right. Good. That's good. It's also for lobbyists, right? If they enter your office, you know, they are sometimes coming up with really, really nonsense arguments. And they know with me they can't get away with it. So they need to do their homework a bit better.
What is the most preposterous argument that you've ever heard?
This is really, you know, companies like Shell who are then still trying to defend that they're doing very good things for the climate and then trying to come up with, no, but we need then carbon capture and storage. But if you then talk about the volumes they need to put under the ground, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. So if we move to a zero emission economy, sorry, then there's no place for companies like Shell if they don't shift away from gas.
onto the topic of the far right. Why does the far right so often attack efforts to protect the climate? Is it... I'll throw out a suggestion.
Sure, yeah.
Is it because climate change is a global problem with no national solution, making climate just kind of too much of a head fuck for somebody with a nationalist paradigm to handle?
I think it doesn't fit the narrative, no. And the other way around, they are fighting the elite, right? That's their big fight. We are against the elite, and somehow climate change is a difficult one. It's indeed cross-border, but also the solutions are quite fundamental to our economy. So I think all that together is so challenging that they feel like this is another elitist project, and at least they know that it's resonates well if they tell that back home. So I think it's an easy victim.
Climate is fairly easy for them to ridicule because scientists are rarely 100% sure of causalities.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if that's part of it. And also, as you kind of was suggesting earlier, fossil fuel industries are kind of in bed with the far right because they can kind of use that as leverage.
Well, yeah, but you know what I never get my head around is that if you are really, you know, most of the populace are so much concerned about the Islam, right? That's another famous enemy. Well, sorry, we are importing fossil fuels every day, billions and billions, and that is going to regimes like Saudi Arabia or apparently Iran, that might be even worse. So maybe even from that perspective, you could say maybe climate change policies would be in your benefit for a populist. But apparently that's all too complicated, and then it's just easier to say that it's another elitist project that wants to conquer the world through climate change policy.
Very interesting. I wonder what they would say to that. I could imagine it would be, well, you know, Islam at home with Islam is fine. We just don't want it over here or something. But we are.
But then subsidizing regimes who are then subsidizing mosques, you know, it's okay. I'll leave that to them to explain.
So a tactic of the far right is to say that ordinary people are paying higher prices for, say, petrol because of what they would call environmental zealotry. You can see
you studied the language pretty well.
Once you go into that rabbit hole, you pick up some of their terms. You can see some of that reflected in the protests by the Gilets Jaunes or the Yellow Jackets against fuel prices, and that's been backed by Marine Le Pen of the French far right. I sort of see a threatening message there for the Greens, you know, that environmentalism is helping drive inequalities in society. And here's my question. If the Greens really want to be the alternative to populism and even win over some of those protesters, doesn't that imply talking a bit less about the climate?
No, really not. But I do think, you know, the point is that where the populists are feeding on is, of course, a lot of dissatisfaction that is around in the society. And to be very honest, we Greens see the same. We see a huge dissatisfaction. I think we always call them the center parties, the status quo parties. I think the problem is what people feel is that too long the center parties have been giving all the advantages, all the credits to big companies at the cost of the consumers. If you see in the euro crisis, in the time of the euro crisis, you would expect politically what you do is then make sure that labor is getting cheaper, right? Because then you can create employment. What happened is that taxation on labor went up and taxation on profits for companies went down. Why? Because every European country is competing for those companies to get it and therefore lowering the tax levels. And now with the Brexit coming up, what are the Brits promising? Even lower tax rate for companies because they want to attract the companies away from Europe. This race to the bottom is ongoing for decades now, and people feel that. You see it in the statistics that companies are paying less and less taxes and that it needs to come from somewhere. Or you put the taxes on that, but it's less mobile, and very cynically, that's the people. Or you are cutting your expenditure, and there you get the entire austerity that we've seen during the crisis. That together created the feeling that there is a huge disproportionate and unfair distribution of the costs. If then on top, and then we get to the green policies, if then on top, and that's a bit what Macron is doing, his first real green action is only a levy, a tax, a further tax on consumption for the people, then of course people will feel that they're being hit once more. So I don't see this resistance as going against green policies, because weeks before, same Paris had a huge climate march, people concerned about climate. That's not the problem. The problem is if you're doing the policies wrong, if you don't do a fair distribution of the costs, then it goes wrong. And I think Macron did it wrong. In the Netherlands, we call ourselves Groen Links, which stands for Green Left. And I think that says it all. For us, green policy should go hand in hand with economic fair distribution, a left policy. Then it can work. If you don't do that, then you will only feed the dissatisfaction that we see now in the Paris streets.
I mean, distilling that green left sales pitch is your challenge.
That is going to be the challenge, of course. What is going to be very important in the campaign is that we Greens show that green policy should always be combined with fair economic policies, which really means it's kind of putting the principle in place that the polluter really pays, which is not what we're doing right now. For example, in the Netherlands, very simple example, the more energy you use, the less tax on energy you pay, relatively speaking. Usually, if you want to do a progressive tax system, you are taxing that what you want to have less, right? So, but the big companies pay less, the big energy consumers pay less taxes on their kilowatt hour of energy consumed than a normal citizen. That kind of unfairness, that is really eating this, it's undercutting, undermining the support for climate policies, which are there, but we need to do it right.
How, in your experience as a politician, does the populist far right suppress climate science or promote policies that harm the climate? Have you seen evidence of this, say, in Dutch politics or in your everyday work in the European Parliament?
You see the populists fighting it. They try to put in amendments on any climate policy. They put in amendments that are just deleting entire articles.
Really? So we're talking about EFDD and
ENF.
And ENF?
Yeah.
Sorry about those acronyms. The EFDD and ENF are the two main groups of nationalist populists in the European Parliament. The EFDD is a motley crew comprised mainly of members of the UK Independence Party and the Italian Five Star Movement. The ENF, on the other hand, is far right to its core. It's mainly made up of members of the French National Rally, the crypto-fascists formerly known as the National Front, the Italian League, and the Dutch Party for Freedom.
Yeah, they're just putting in a, you know, really literally amendments, delete Article 8, delete Article 9, delete Article 10, so more or less you don't have a law left anymore.
Are they doing that in order to be vexatious, or are they doing that in order to really genuinely change the law?
I never get the feeling they generally want to change it. They just put it in so that they can show on the record that they have been putting in amendments, but they know it will be voted down. They are never present when we are discussing compromises. The only thing they do is putting in amendments and doing plenary speeches.
That amounts to wasting people's time?
It's certainly wasting a lot of taxpayers' money on people who are just, you know, only pretending to be very active in a plenary speech, but for the rest, I never see them. For the EPP, so the Christian Democrats, they are part of the negotiations at least, and they try to weaken the law, but at least they do that through being active in the process. The real populists on the right, ENF, less about EFDD, by the way, but that's because we have the Five Stars, who is always a kind of a, you know, you never know which face is turning up. But on environmental issues, they are quite helpful. But all the ENF parties, you only see them with amendments. You vote them down and you never see them anymore until a plenary speech where they just say that it's all nonsense. You take note and you move on.
Okay. Now, we see the far right AfD in Germany pushing for Germany now to leave the Paris Agreement.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is a kind of common coordinated tactic by the far right across Europe?
I'm not sure to what extent it's coordinated, but I do think they are using the same playbook. They all see that fighting Europe, fighting the EU, fighting multilateralism comes together with also fighting climate change policies and therefore fighting Paris. And I think that some of these players have shown that it brings you a kind of a consistent agenda. and others are copying. And I think the AfD is just doing that because, of course, in Germany, there's a huge debate around the energy transition, etc. And in order to be different from the others, they do this. And they know that's the way to get attention. And that's just copying. They're just using the same playbook.
What happens in a Brussels where there are where the parliament has, instead of 10% far-right populists, let's say 20%, let's say where the commission has four commissioners from countries where climate skepticism is rife? That is a very, very plausible scenario for post-May 2019. Are you worried about the implications for Europe's climate leadership?
To be very honest, I'm more worried what the center parties are going to do, and then especially the Christian Democrats. I think that that is going to be the big question.
You mean if Orbán is still part of that group?
If Orbán is still part of that group, but also look Austria, where the Christian Democrats are now working together with the FPÖ, so they are now getting the right-wing populist, extreme right populist into the government. So what you see happening is that the EPP is slowly shifting to that in that direction, and then it becomes much more serious. But I think until now we can handle it, but well, that's probably the center party needs some good counterweight on the other side, and that's probably where the Greens come in.
So if there was one country, Poland would be the most problematic from the climate perspective right government.
Well, Poland is most outspoken on it, yes. And in that sense, they have been the most problematic one. But again, the biggest problem for me more is a country like Germany that is kind of course, different, absolutely different. But if you look at how they position them in the latest files around coal phase out, around cars, they are very close to Poland suddenly. And that is, of course, a problem when such a reliable, solid country is moving its positions to these kind of topics so much to the right. Then, of course, it becomes difficult to get to any meaningful deal in Europe. That is really a problem.
French President Emmanuel Macron has basically said, it's me or Salvini.
Yeah.
In these May 2019 European elections, Macron seems to be warning voters that a vote for anyone else but his kind of Macronist liberal center will help the far right, as embodied by the Italian Lega and Matteo Salvini.
Yeah.
And Salvini, of course, will undermine the European Union and its humanistic values. What is the Greens' response to this kind of rhetorical challenge from Macron? Why is it so troublesome for you?
It's not troublesome, it's dangerous. Because if you're just limiting the debate around Europe to a very binary question, either you're for or against, what you're doing is making the people who are critical on Europe but absolutely see the values of European cooperation, you put them in a kind of a corner where they don't feel there is an alternative to them. And that is really very dangerous. I mean, I understand it from Macron's perspective. This is what made him president in France. But to be very honest, that can work in France because in the end, you have to choose a president. So it's a binary choice in the end. Europe, at the European level, it doesn't work. We have we have many different parties, and then trying to make it a binary choice with for or against, you're not only making your own position maybe stronger, you're also helping the populists.
That's EU Scream for this week. You can check our website at euscream.com for links to topics discussed in the show and for more episodes. Please rate us on iTunes, tweet about us at EU Screams, and like us on Facebook. EU Scream is edited and mixed by me, James Cantor. Tom Brooks and I produce the show. Laura Natale plays our piano. Thanks for listening.